I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anelio, and you're listening to The Functional Nerds. This is going to be episode number 230.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com. You can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anelio. I'm a musician and a composer and a podcaster. You can check out our website, functionalnerds.com. You can check out my music, johnanelio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanelio. And today, we are happy to be joined by Ferret Steinmetz. He is an author and a blogger and a social media personality.
Loudmouth,
and he's got a brand new book out through Angry Robot Books, and it is called Flex, and I just finished reading it, and it is awesome, and we're going to talk about that amongst other things. You could check out him on Twitter at, well, let's see, can you throw out your Twitter and your website for us, Ferret?
Yeah, it's weird because my name is weird. It's Ferret himself on Twitter, and that's two R's, two T's. And my website is The Ferret, T-H-E-F-E-R-R-E-T-T. My entire family spells the name of the animal ferret wrong because of me. I apologize to anybody who's confused.
Right, so there you go. So Ferret, thank you so much for joining us today. And Ferret is one of these guys that I've been friendly with on Twitter for a long time. And so when you see these folks and they get published, it's very exciting because there's a lot of authors that are, you know, trying to get their stuff published, and you know, when you see someone that you've kind of known for a while online and they get it, it always makes me happy. So why don't we start a little bit with that? How did this book end up getting published by Angry Robot?
It's kind of a long saga, but the short version is this is the book where I completely gave up hope of getting published. Because what happened was I've been writing novels since I was 15. I turned 46 in a couple months, and I wrote a whole bunch of novels that were commercial and were going to be good for people. And after writing seven of those and having all of them tank hideously one way or the other, including one where it's like, hey, you got nominated for the Nebula Award in 2012. We still hate your novel. you know, I just keep taking body blow after body blow to my ego. So I wrote this novel, and basically, it's got all the stuff I like in it, and it seemed horrifically self-indulgent at the time because it features video game mancy, bureaucromancy, where a guy makes magic out of paperwork. One of the most frequently asked questions I get on this is, why are there so many references to donuts? And the answer is, because I really like donuts. and this is the novel where I just wrote something entirely.
Are there any bear claws?
Are there any what?
Bear claws.
Oh, yeah, there are bear claws. You get judged for eating bear claws, though.
Excellent.
Bear claws and claws.
Excellent.
You know. But yeah, so this is the novel that was just personally me 100%. And, of course, that's the one that clicks. Go figure. So.
Yeah, and it clicked with me, too, and I have lots of questions for you about the book as we get into it.
What is the book, John?
It is called Flex. I already told you. That's the name of the book. It's Flex.
I don't remember you saying it.
Oh, I thought I said it. Anyway, that's the name of it. And it's not about, you know, guys flexing their muscles, although there is a little bit of that in there a little bit. But
it's not like the novelization of that Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary workout film.
Oh, Pumping Iron. Yeah.
Awesome. I love that.
Yeah, that should be your next book. And you should call that one Flex, too. But just really confuse the hell out of people having two totally different books.
All of my novels from now on are going to be called Flex, just to screw with the bookstores.
Wouldn't that trip people out if like an author released several books that were all the same name but completely different books?
You would have to do it from different publishers, but I would love to see the long game of somebody trying for that.
Well, you know, that's sort of like, I think Cory Doctorow has done that with, I think he's done it more with short stories where he's taken sort of these classic golden age science fiction stories and used the exact same title and then wrote a totally different story with that title, which I think is kind of an interesting thing. But anyway, because I really do want to dive right into some of the aspects of the book, but let's get into our picks of the week first. picks of the week. And Barrett, do you have a pick for us?
I do. I'm going to recommend one of my favorite movies of all time. It is a documentary, going back to what we were just talking about, and it's called The King of Kong. And if you're a writer or interested in, nerdery, it is like one of the best constructed movies you will ever watch. Because I have made at least 10 people watch this movie against their will. Because when I tell them, it's a movie about the world's best Donkey Kong players going head-to-head in an evil battle with each other, people go, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. Who would want to watch two Donkey Kong nerds going head-to-head? Then halfway through the movie, in the middle of this catastrophic battle between the good Donkey Kong player and the bad Donkey Kong player, and keep in mind, this is real life, and there is actually a good Donkey Kong player and a bad Donkey Kong player. I've had people get up off their seat and go, no, he didn't do that! And then they're hooked for the rest of the movie.
Is Billy Mitchell the name of the bad Donkey Kong, the evil Donkey Kong player? Do I have his name right?
Billy Mitchell is the name of the evil Donkey Kong player. He is the possessor of the world's most impermeable mullet.
Yes.
His initials, which he goes out of his way to point out, are USA whenever he does anything on the thing, because he believes very firmly in his country and the hot sauce that he's continually selling. Yeah. And he cheats at Donkey Kong, and I can't tell you how he cheats, and it's arguable that he cheats. I think he cheated. But yeah, it's pretty incredible what goes on there. So,
well, now I have to watch that because I'm trying to figure out how you would cheat at Donkey Kong.
Well, the thing is, he's actually really, really amazingly good at video games, so he kind of doesn't need to, but he takes some shortcuts, and when you get to that point in the movie, I've had people, like, literally, like I said, get to their feet and go, this cannot be! And I'm like, you know,
well, see,
they
now,
all come out of my house.
Now I've got the sound effect in my head, you know, ba-da-leanin, 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 ba-da-leanin.
Yeah, I love that, Doug. I watched it. It was on Netflix. I don't know if it's on Netflix right now. It's on Hulu. I just noticed the other day it's up on Hulu if you have Hulu, or I guess you could watch it online too, but definitely worth watching, Patrick. It's great because especially if you're a person of our age, Farrah just said he's 45, I'm 41. I know you're in there too, Patrick.
I am
25. 25. Or you could be like my aunt who was like in her 70s and be like, I'm 29 plus.
Yes.
She said 29 plus until she was in her 70s. It's like, yeah. Anyway. But it really, you know, when you have those old classic video games like that you had to go to an arcade to play, the sort of skill involved is a totally different skill set than, you know, sort of more modern video games, because it was, you only had a couple of lives and it was about surviving, really. And it was really, I think, just a testament to perseverance as much as hand-eye coordination. And it reminded, you know, thinking about that movie now, it reminds me, because I had recently read Ready Player One, by Ernest Cline, and sort of now I'm thinking about The King of Kong, and I'm like, oh, there's a lot of like sort of not parallels, but at least sort of some touchstones there about, you know, sort of growing up sort of obsessed with video games and playing it. And this is a movie about video game obsession for sure.
Oh, I
and actually, in point of fact, the sequel, which I'm writing to Flex right now, right in the first chapter, it has both an explicit Billy Mitchell reference and an explicit Ernie Cline reference, which anybody can pick up on, because I'm obsessed with video games too. So,
I used to go to 7-Eleven and play video games. And I remember being, just talking about the culture for a second, I remember being really angry when there was a new game there and it was just the best game. And I think it was the track and field game. And it had the ball that you would spin to do stuff. And I was so into that game. And I go in one day and the board where the ball and the buttons are and everything, the little console part, right, had melted in the corner. And I couldn't figure out why it was melting in the corner the way it was. And it turned out people were going in there. This is when you could smoke in public.
Mm-hmm.
And people would go in there and they would set their cigarettes on the corner of the console piece. And it would burn down and it was melting the plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, that angered me. I was like, no, you're ruining the machine.
Well, for that game, there was another game that was very similar. Where the whole point was to hit buttons really as fast as you could. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, I feel really old when I say, this was in the days before the internet. But, you know, back when you could only really pass on these tricks like magicians handing the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I saw somebody basically you had to hit these two alternating buttons very fast to make it work. And the first time I saw somebody bring in a pencil with a lever and just right between them, I'm like, oh my God, you are the magic.
I remember, so, you know, it's, as we're relaying like video game stories, I just remember people do that thing where, like, if you were playing and they would, like, sort of stick their quarter on the machine, like, mm-hmm. yeah. I got the next game, yep. asshole, like, stop hogging the machine. And I remember, like, older guys, like, guys that were probably, like, 16 or 17 when I was 11 or something, just if you sort of hovered around the machine too much and they, like, their character died, they would look at you and be like, you've messed me up, man. You messed me up. Get out of my, like, I just remember, like, a lot of, you know, sort of territorialism around the machines. But, Farid, you know, I have a question for you with that. Like, what do you think of what is your feeling about Spielberg being tapped for Ready Player One now?
I have mixed opinions about it. My wife summed it up best for me. She said, if it was the Spielberg from 30 years ago, I would be really thrilled. Mm-hmm. The Spielberg we've seen lately, not so much. I'm glad he has the juice where he can get all of those video games, and I know he can drag all the D&D references in there, because he did that for Roger Rabbit, essentially. He didn't direct Roger Rabbit, but he produced it. Mm-hmm. I know he can direct a good movie. I just don't know that he's necessarily in touch with the roots of this one. I'm hoping really big, because my friend Angie is literally one of the world's biggest Ernie Cline fans. Mm-hmm. She has read the book probably 40 times. Wow. So I hope, if only for my sake of mind, so I don't have to deal with her texting me 5 times a day going, why, that the movie is good. So.
Me too. Cool. All right. Well, you know, let me get on to my pick then. My pick is going to be, I mentioned Cory Doctorow earlier, and I'm going to pick his most recent book, which is Information Doesn't Want to Be Free, Laws for the Internet Age. I'm a much bigger fan of Cory Doctorow's nonfiction than I am for his fiction. I've read a couple of his novels, too, and they're fine. But I really get a lot out of his thinking on these matters. And this is a very... it's a book, you know, it's sort of marketed towards, you know, people who are doing artistic things online. And there is some of that. There's some advice for, you know, if you're a writer or a musician or a visual artist or whatever, and, you know, you want to get your art out there. But it's really about, it does get very into the nuts and bolts of copyright and, you know, entertainment industry and how it really, what it makes, it makes you feel two things. It makes you, I felt very paranoid after reading this, because he basically,
that's
just
every Cory Doctorow book.
Yeah, I think you're right, but it's just, you know, how much, basically what he's arguing for in this book, as in a lot of his nonfiction and a lot of his pieces that he writes online, is to try to keep the internet open and to keep the internet free and to keep it so that, because it's crucial to our culture and to our development as human beings nowadays. It's really, it's not just a delivery system for the entertainment industry, which the entertainment industry would like to believe. It's like, no, this is now our delivery system for our movies and our music and what have you.
I thought it was a delivery system for porn.
Well, that's in the entertainment industry. Oh, okay. let's not argue about that. No, but it's so, you know, when you have, you know, DRM and all the other things that are sort of locking down certain aspects of it. You know, I'm someone that's pretty blind to all of that. Like, you know, like I've purchased a million eBooks on Amazon, and I know, you know, according to Doctorow, like, I didn't purchase that book. I purchased a license to access that eBook on my device. And yeah, he's right, but it doesn't really matter to me because I'm going to read it on that Kindle and that's the end. But I understand what he's saying, but it is stuff that we should be aware of because, you know, people who have power want more power and more control. And, you know, for artists, we want to be able to, you know, have that. So it's a thought provoking.
It also matters for the future.
Yes.
It also matters for the future because there was a big article, and again, we're going back to classic video games, but that seems to be the way this podcast is flowing. I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
but there was talking about how, I think it was Electronic Arts, basically said anybody, any museum who wanted to archive the video games that they had rights to were hackers and had no right to, and it was illegal. So it's entirely possible, thanks to these rules that Corey has been shouting about for years, that in 40 years we'll have no idea what Rock Band or Assassin's Creed or any of these things look like, because you have companies that will basically lock them down and refuse to give up, you know, give up rights to them. So not only is there, you know, you sort of blow off the Kindle for right now, and that's, you know, I think we all make that choice. But in 30 years, it could be a much, much bigger deal than we even dream of. Well, and that's what he's kind of pointing at.
Were you aware of, like, the multiple arcade machine emulator that was kind of popular in the late 90s, early 2000s?
I built one, and I have one in my basement. So.
Well, I'm talking about it was actually on PC first. So you basically had people out there who, like us, loved these classic video games but couldn't play them anymore because you couldn't find them. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what they were doing was people were taking the PROMs, which is the hardware inside that is the video game. And they were essentially trying to translate them using this multiple arcade machine emulator into something that you could play online. And they did that because they were like, well, you know, no one's doing anything with these games. No one's putting them out. No one's doing anything. So we're just going to, you know, we still want to play them. We're going to put them out there. And now you've got, like, the Internet Archive.
Yeah, they just did a big thing with all those.
Yeah, they've got all those games out. So, yeah, I mean, for like really, a month straight, I was playing Burger Time every night.
Oh my God, yeah. That is a great thing, because I brought my daughters to an old-time video arcade, which has drinks. And they were just shocked at Burger Time. They were like, what the heck is this? I'm like, just throw the pepper at it.
Throw the pepper. What is Burger Time? It's what they used when Donkey Kong was no longer popular. They pulled the Donkey Kong P-ROM out. They put the Burger Time P-ROM in. They changed the stickers on the box, and suddenly you had a different game.
They did that? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then when Burger Time wasn't popular anymore, they pulled the Burger Time PROM out, they put Dig Dug in, and again, they changed the stickers in the box.
Man, I love cheap corporations. They get so great.
Cool. All right, Patrick, what is your pick then?
My pick this week is Star Trek Renegades.
Ooh, the trailer for that just came out.
They
correct?
Do have a trailer for that. So there's a group of people. Gosh, I know this is gonna just sound so unusual, especially for a group that's on the internet. But there's a group of fans who aren't happy.
What?
And I mean, they're completely playing. Yeah, they're completely playing against cast here. And so there's a group of fans who aren't happy with the movies, and they feel that Star Trek really belongs on television. Despite Enterprise. Anyway, so they are campaigning very, very hard for CBS to bring Star Trek back to television. And as part of their campaign, they have essentially like crowdfunded this Star Trek Renegades trailer, and they're trying to get a full-length pilot done. And it's got some name power, you know, associated with it. Tim Russ, who was Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and he also played a character on one of the last movies from Star Trek, and for the original cast. And Walter Koenig is in it, and Robert Picardo is in it, and they've got a lot of other kind of genre actors and actresses as part of it. And what they're doing is it's like Suicide Squad for the Federation. If you're familiar with Suicide Squad, these are the DC Universe bad guys and gals who are brought together in the current versions by Amanda Waller to be part of the Suicide Squad. You know, these are people, they have little bombs in their neck, and they go off and they do things that the heroes won't do. And in this case, it's they bring together these people from these criminals and different folks with questionable, sketchy backgrounds, and they go around the Federation and unencumbered by the Prime Directive or the rules of Starfleet, trying to save the Federation from stuff.
Oh my God, I can hear Gene Roddenberry screaming in his grave.
Well, the trailer is extremely impressive. I mean, they've definitely spent some money on this. So it looks pretty decent, and I'm very interested in what they do with it. Obviously, I don't think the way the rights are between Paramount and CBS, I can't imagine them being able to do a TV show without J.J. Trek giving his permission.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a neat trailer.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. All right. Well, as Ferret alluded to earlier, he was talking about how his book Flex is very personal, and that's oddly the one that got published. And I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed this book so much is because it's the main character is a dad, and he's not a 17-year-old, trying to find himself. And as much as I love the hell out of a great, 17-year-old hero's journey with the sword and all that stuff, I found this so relatable because the character is a dad and has a job. And so much of that really spoke to me. So the first thing I want to ask you about, Ferret, is in this book, what's really central, I think, to the book is the main character is Paul, and he has a daughter, and it's sort of his relationship with his young daughter, I think, is really central to the book and obviously very believable. And you already mentioned that you have a couple daughters. So, talk a little bit about that, that relationship in the book and, how much of that is sort of inspired by your life.
Well, it's kind of a real bittersweet thing here. For the record, the pitch for the novel is Breaking Bad meets Jim Butcher, which I think is inaccurate, but it's close enough. Basically, his daughter gets horribly burned in a fire, and he basically has to go off and do magic in order to protect her, but he's not very good with his magic, and in the world of Flex, magic has a lot of backlash, which can kill you instantly. It's not an effortless thing. In fact, the universe hates magic and tends to rain bad coincidences down back around you until the odds are more or less evened off. So with every act of magic comes its corresponding counterbalance. Learning to basically save his daughter is the main point of the book, and that's what people have reacted to, which I'm really happy about. And the reason it feels real is partially because I am a stepfather. I have two daughters who I love now. I've had them for 15 years, and they're both very dear to me. The part that is very bittersweet is when I started writing the book, I had a goddaughter named Rebecca, and she was at the time 4.5 years old. She was one of the spunkiest kids I ever knew. She basically would, laugh in your face, and she was the only 3-year-old I ever met who totally got sarcasm right from the get-go. Like, the minute I was just snarky with her, she went, "Oh, yeah," and then proceeded to be snarky back at me. And so when I was looking for a really snarky 6-year-old, I basically said, well, who would that be? And I based Alaya, who is the daughter, on Rebecca, who unfortunately went on to get brain cancer and died on her 6th birthday.
Oh, that's terrible.
So there's a very real feel to it, and I'm really happy because a lot of the novel was, formed around me not trying to capture Rebecca, but to make sure that if I got Rebecca right, not to translate her essence, but to sort of say, if I'm going to write a kid, I have to get this perfect. And I'm really glad to hear that basically that father-daughter relationship came through, because while I was revising, a lot of that was going on with Rebecca. And so you can sense a lot of that tension in there as I'm writing some hospital scenes and other things, which are drawn very directly from real life. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very authentic. It's not heavy-handed or use. It's what the relationship between a parent and their child often is. And what, you mentioned with the magic in the book, which I think any book any novel that uses some sort of magic system, I think the ones that are, the most readable, the most compelling are the ones where there is a cost for the magic. It's not hand wavy and I can do what I want. It's you feel with every decision that any of the people that can use magic in the novel that there is a very real, very heavy cost, and all of that has to be thought about before they decide to do anything. So is there any particular, magic system, not the system itself, but maybe sort of that cost that in other kinds of movies or books or games or something that sort of inspired the magic that is in the world of Flex?
Actually, interestingly enough, it's quite the opposite, which is I took everything that I hated about Doctor Strange and tried to make it the opposite. And for the record, let me give you the pitch on the magic system in Flex, because it's a little bit weird, and I think your listeners might be interested in that, because The way it works, you're sort of talking about, we have a bureaucromancer, we have a video game mancer, there are all these other kinds of crazy magicians in here. The way it works in the world of Flex is that if you are a crazy cat lady and you really absolutely love your kittens so hard, you can actually punch a hole through the laws of the universe and start doing crazy cat magic. You become a philomancer and you start doing all sorts of magic related to that. The problem is that by the time you become a full-blown philomancer, you're bull goose crazy. So what you need is not going to be what normal people need. So your magic is going to reflect that. And then, as I mentioned, there's the backlash. And that all came from loving Doctor Strange as I do, but Doctor Strange is a terrible, terrible character. He's a great character, don't get me wrong, but his magic is so ill-defined and sort of screws up from writer to writer that literally every time he faces down some sort of threat, you don't know what he can do. Like, you know he's got these things, you know he's got the Crimson Bands of Sidorak and all that, but what's their limitations? When is he actually in trouble? And if you look closely at every Doctor Strange comic, whenever he faces somebody, there literally has to be a full panel where he has a thought bubble above his head going, oh my god, it's this guy. I can't beat him with my magic. Or he has to tell you that this is an equal battle, or he has to explicitly state the stakes at the beginning of every conflict. And I wanted a magic system where you had a rough idea what somebody was good at, and you had a rough idea of how much trouble somebody could get into, so I wouldn't have to tell you the stakes, you would just be aware of them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's much of a surprise to say that you have the lead character, Paul. He's a bureaucromancer. He loves forms. He's basically a superpowered DMV. He can do amazing things with paperwork. You get him into a book gunfight, he's not going to be much good at it. And I think you know that instinctively, and that's one of the things I was trying to do that with magic.
So,
you have Valentine, the video game mancer, who all she has to do is channel Grand Theft Auto, and you're in deep, deep trouble.
Ferret. So MTV decides to revive Celebrity Deathmatch, and in this corner you have Stephen Strange, and in this corner you have John Constantine. Fight!
Ooh. Oh, my God. John Constantine takes him out in a heartbeat. John Constantine plays dirty. I'm sorry. John Constantine would have him dead before he even showed up at the theater. He would have picked something beforehand. So, you know.
That just reminds me of many years ago when I used to read Wizard Magazine, the comic book magazine. I don't even know if they make that anymore. I think they still do. But they would often do those, like, what would happen if Batman and this character got into a fight? What would happen with this? And my favorite one that they ever wrote up with that was Batman versus Daredevil. And it was... yeah, this would be over in a minute because Batman would realize, hey, he's blind. And he would just throw a bunch of, like, you know, sonic bombs at him and just, like, totally disorient him and beat the crap out of him. And I'm like, that's so true. I just love that. They were just like, hey.
did you guys happen to see, there was the fan video where it's Batman goes to the Death Star because Darth Vader has captured Superman.
No.
And he ends up in a lightsaber duel with Darth Vader. And it's kind of cool because he uses his technology, Batman does, to disable Darth Vader's breathing apparatus. So, you know, he's having trouble breathing and it's that whole thing. And so they did two versions of it. In the first version, Batman loses to Darth Vader because Darth Vader, Lord of the Sith. In the other version, he manages to get Superman out. And it still looks like he's going to lose, but then suddenly there's a blue streak and bam, you know, Superman's there, you know, floating behind Batman going, thanks, Bruce. And Darth Vader's all, bleh. So anyway, there's a great video. It's an awesome, awesome video. I think I even talked like DiNardo into putting it on SF Signal. So you should go check it out. It's Batman versus Darth Vader.
Cool. You know, Farrah, one of the other things I wanted to ask you about in your book, you know, you mentioned Valentine, who is one of the main characters in the book. She's a video game mancer. And one of the things I really loved that you did with her character, and I read a couple of interviews that you've done about the book, and you mentioned this in one of the interviews, and I didn't even think about it until after I read it, was that Valentine is not a thin woman. Valentine is a woman who's overweight and is very comfortable with her body. And you never, and one of the things you mentioned in this interview is that how, and she's sort of gothy. You describe her as gothy at points in the book. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you mentioned in this interview is that you wanted, or maybe it was in the back of the book when you were talking about some of the people that helped you out with some of the characters. You're talking about how a lot of times people will, when they're reading a book, they will imagine, you know, the body type of a character, and how it could have been so easy, like, for people just to imagine some waify goth girl in this role. And I never did, and I always imagined her as you described her, but it's not like you went out of your way to describe her constantly through the book. So what, you know, how do you feel like you went about doing that, and was that important to you?
It was totally important to me, because one of the things that I see when I go to conventions is I see all these tremendously strongly personalityed women of varying, you know, body shapes. And some of the, you know, strongest women I know are, you know, heavy, for lack of a better term. The problem with talking about overweight women is pretty much any term you use to describe somebody who is packing extra pounds becomes an insult. So it then sounds like I'm insulting them by talking about them when I'm just trying to describe them. But yeah, I know a lot of women in, you know, conventions, in particularly the kink community, because I deal with them, who are hefty and really, really comfortable with who they are. And I wanted to have somebody like that reflected in the novel, because everybody you see in a lot of the urban fantasy novels is very traditionally attractive. And I go out of my way to say that Valentine is A, overweight, and B, really, really fucking pretty. And and I did that via, and you say I didn't bring that up constantly throughout the novel, but in fact I did. Because after watching the reactions to Rue in The Hunger Games, where she's coded as black once, and then fans forgot about her and sort of made her white, and hence were very upset by the film casting of her as black, I very carefully seeded little words throughout the novels like pudgy, heavy, talking about her weight, trying to do it very discreetly so I wasn't like punching you in the face with it, but just these quiet little signals that no, she is in fact not a skinny, waify girl like you mentioned. And I think it helped that Valentine's a very powerful character in terms of she has a strong personality, she's comfortable in who she is, and she's got all the best one-liners, so I think people tend to kind of just react to her positively and keep that in mind. So
Because you don't read characters like that often enough, and as you said, it's reflecting who is in society, and I think particularly in the science fiction and fantasy community and the gaming community as well. So, you know, to not have enough characters like that is kind of foolish. So I thought you did an awesome job with that. So unfortunately, we are running a little low on time. So you know. First of all, I want to thank Ferret on the podcast. Ferret switched his time because we had a little bit of one of our other guests that we were interviewing today had some stuff going on, so we had to move some things around. So Ferret, thank you for being flexible with your time. Do you have any, so obviously people can go to your website and your Twitter, and once again, the book is Flex, and it is from Angry Robot Books, and it is out now. Do you have any conventions coming up or anything else that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
I'm going to WorldCon, which is going to be fun. So if anybody wants to see me there, I'll be happy to see you there.
I'll be there.
And also today, hello, woo, okay. The other thing is that I'm literally finishing up the sequel to this novel of it today. So if you happen to like Flex, the sequel is going to be out in October, which is super quick, but I'm told this is what they want, so I'm going with it. So if you liked Flex, there's more coming, and there's more crazy, crazy magic on the way. Also,
awesome.
Horribly wounded dogs. So,
cool. All right. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Same old, same old. Let's see here. You can always follow me on Twitter at ATFMB. I'll be at Pikes Peak Writers Conference April 24th, 25th, 26th. So come and check me out there. I've got stuff over at Kirkus, and I always have the SF Signal podcast. So.
Awesome. Very good. And you can check us out over at functionalnerds.com. I've been writing these book recommendation posts. So if you like that sort of thing, you can sign up in the form on the right side of the website, and I will email you my book recommendations every few weeks. And I'm sure Flex is going to be one of them soon because I just finished it. So do that, please. And you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio, and check out my music over at johnanilio.com. All right, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Ferret.
Woo!
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?